This is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, apparently, over the last 20 years or so, while we weren't listening, numerous companies figured out how to monetize the idea of recovery. Recovery from athletic endeavor, that is, with a strong dose of pseudoscience, marketing dollars, and the human desire to go faster sooner. We've all been told and sold a plethora of gadgets and gimmicks to get us back out there as soon as possible for a price. Joining us now to debunk the worst and the funniest of the recovery myths is Christy Ashwanden, science writer, health columnist, elite athlete, and author of the new book, which is quite a wonderful read, Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. Christy, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really wonderful to have you. And you have a fan club in Park City. Oh. I just got a call from Mary Closser, who said, please tell Christy hello. I knew her from Boulder. So, wow, your reputation precedes you.
Hi, Mary. Yeah, that's so nice.
So, again, well, I'll be the second person in your fan club here in Park City. What I read, a critical review of your new book, and someone said, you are the best science writer out there. And I will say that just starting your book, it was immediately entertaining. And of course, like Tim said earlier, because we want to know all about how beer is a great recovery drink.
Absolutely. So, yeah, the first chapter of my book is actually about beer and running. And so I had this question, which is beer a good recovery drink? I think I'm not alone in this. A lot of my running friends and cycling friends, we like to have a beer after our workout. It's a way to kind of unwind and relax together. It's quite refreshing and enjoyable, but I started to think, is this really a good idea? You know, I think that alcohol is a little bit like coffee. You know, it's so pleasurable, but it also feels a little bit potent, and so we really love it, but we also sort of have this deep suspicion that maybe it's not so good for us, and, you know, even as we really hope that it is good for us, right?
Yeah. So, go ahead.
Yeah, so the first chapter is about how I sort of went on this quest to answer that question, and it's something that seems like a pretty straightforward question, right? Is beer, you know, is drinking a beer after a run going to harm your recovery? And so what I found, though, I teamed with some researchers at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction, and we decided to do a study on this, to actually look at it scientifically. But what I discovered is it's really hard to answer even a simple question with a single study. And so that chapter on beer and running really sort of walks readers through this process, why science is difficult, why small studies can be really interesting but may not offer definitive answers. But I know that people really want to know the takeaway, which is a little bit of beer is probably okay. And if you are also having a little bit of food and some water along with the beer, it's a perfectly fine recovery drink.
Mm. Well, and especially if you mix it with lemonade or limeade and make a, what do they call those things, a shanty or whatever it is. So diluting the alcohol, shall we say. But I did find it really interesting, this research study that you went through. And you, as you, even though you were the administrator of the study in part, you were finding that, you know, different sizes of study and different techniques and different motivations behind the study really so much influence it. But I wanted to just be good with the part where you learned that for women, beer is a good recovery drink. For men, not so much.
Yeah, that's right. We found that. And, you know, it was a really exciting result, especially, you know, for me, because I'm married to a man, and this seemed like a great opportunity to have a designated driver. You know, it's like, okay, this beer is great for me. It's not so good for you. You can drive us home. It's all good, right? But the problem was that I had trouble believing this result. And in part, it was because our study was so small. And so even though we got what's called a statistically significant result, and this basically meant that we ran some statistical tests, it made it seem like, you know, this result was unlikely to happen by chance. And yet our sample was so small that it's possible to get really misleading results. The other thing is, as a participant of the study, I realized that there are all of these little factors that were probably invisible to the researchers that were influencing the result. So I'll just give you an example. Our test for recovery was a thing called run to exhaustion. So we were put on a treadmill, and we had to run as long as we could go. And what this felt like was sort of a psychological test. How motivated are you to continue doing this test? None of us were getting paid. This is just sort of giving up some of your time for science. And so it didn't really feel like a good way to measure the question that we were asking, which is, is beer going to make me feel better or worse the next day? So there was that. There were also some little things I call like inadvertent nudges. We weren't supposed to see the time on the clock so that we would be sort of gaming this, and yet there was a clock on the wall of the lab so I could see and, see how I was doing compared to not having beer. So there are all these just little things that can be hard to quantify and may not come through when you're reading the study in the scientific literature, but that could have a pretty good impact on the results that you're getting.
Christy, how did you get drawn into kind of looking at the systems as well as trying to provide answers? I mean, I find that fascinating. It looks like you chased answers and you found that there were issues with the system that became very intriguing to you.
Yeah, there were. And I think I'm just kind of a science geek at heart. I'm a scientist by training. I had, used to do research before I went into journalism. And so I was familiar with science, the scientific process, and I'm really interested in how this works. And I've become very interested in recent years. I've done a lot of writing about the scientific method and about methodology and why it's so important to studies and how influential it can be in the results that you get. And I think the important thing to know here is that science is a really powerful way of understanding the world, but it's also not perfect. And we too often, I think of science as this magic wand that touches everything it turns everything it touches into truth. But instead, science is really a process. It's not an answer, but it's a process of reducing your uncertainty about things. So in our study, we were looking at beer. Is it good or bad for recovery? And so although we did not get, an absolute definite final answer, we got some hints and we reduced uncertainty about some of the things. So for instance, one of the things that sort of came out of our study is that if beer is having an effect, it's probably a fairly small one in terms of being detrimental.
And were you a STEM kid early on? I mean, you just said you've always loved science, but I mean, when you were in elementary and high school, were you always one of those kids looking at science and technology and math?
Well, I actually skipped a grade because I was ahead in math. So I guess the answer to that is yes. I've always enjoyed science, and I thought in high school I thought I wanted to be a doctor because I loved science so much, and I sort of lacked the imagination to realize that there are other things that I could do with it.
Yeah, I just, I was looking at your bio and we saw the elite cross-country skier. And of course, we love that because we love cross-country skiing here in Utah. I just found it a really interesting mix of different elements in your background. And do you think that the fact that science is a process and you're trying to create clarity in areas that lack clarity sort of created the opportunity for many of these companies to exploit that and create sort of these myths around, sport drinks and supplements and compression, clothing and all the things that we see coming out. And that's going back 15, 20 years ago. I mean, today there's a whole new batch of gimmicks and gizmos that we are being told are good for us. The fit, whatever the fit thing is that you wear on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I discovered as I was researching this book is that so often science is really used as a marketing tool. And so it's not being used as a method of discovery, but it's being used as sort of a way of lending legitimacy to claims that may not be good. But one thing that was really fascinating, too, is that I found that often this was happening with things and products and methods that legitimately worked, but they weren't working by the way that these pseudoscientific explanations were being given. And I'll just give you an example. Some of your listeners may be aware that there was a football game on Sunday, and I'm a health journalist, science journalist by trade on my day job, and on Monday morning, my email inbox was just filled up with press releases from various companies that were trying to claim that their product was responsible for the Patriots' win and for Tom Brady's longevity in his football career. But one of the things so Tom Brady represents a lot of different companies. And one of the things that I tested out while doing this book were these pajamas that he is advocating for. They're made by Under Armour. And these pajamas are supposed to have infrared powers They supposedly, they take your body heat and reflect it back as infrared radiation. And if you remember from physics class, infrared radiation is just another type of heat. So they're basically like warm pajamas, but there are all sorts of space age claims that are made about these pajamas and how they're going to unlock your sleep and help you sleep better. And, the thing that's interesting here is that the scientific claims that were being made about these pajamas really didn't stand up. But what does stand up is the idea that sleep is a really powerful recovery mechanism. And so what you have here is really, a legitimate method for recovery that's very important, which is sleep, that's being monetized and being sort of weirdly oversold. I mean, I don't think that you can oversell the benefits of sleep, but you can oversell, these space-age claims about what a particular pair of pajamas will do. So, if the pajamas are comfortable for you, they might help you sleep better, and that's fine. But the idea that it has something to do with infrared radiation was just sort of ridiculous. When I ran that by some physicists, they just sort of laughed.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Christy Ashwanden. Her new book is Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. And the text messages keep coming in to me about people being in your fan club. Got a message from Dave Hanscom, who you probably know because you're a cross-country skier. No doubt he will be reading your book. And, I want to ask you, I was actually surprised in the beginning of your book when you described this place that you went into in Denver after, I think it was a 5K that you ran, and you ran it probably harder than you should have for the level of training that you were at. You knew you were going to be sore. So you find yourself in this place that it just does recovery. And I'm kind of surprised that we don't have a place like that so far in Park City. But it was just a plethora of these recovery, I don't want to call them all gimmicks, but, and this brings up another point about placebo. So could you address that and talk a little bit about this crazy place you went to?
Sure. I mean, I guess I'll start off by saying that my book has an entire chapter about placebos, so this is a really important factor here. But the Denver Sports Recovery Center, which I went to, and the book actually begins there, where I'm at this place. It's sort of like a gym, except instead of having exercise equipment, it has all of this recovery equipment. So cryotherapy, all sorts of rollers, ice baths, hot baths, cryosauna, an amazing array of devices and things. And it was really interesting to see so many things, on display and up for use. And these things have really become popular with people. And I think one reason is that a lot of these companies are sponsoring elite athletes. And so you have the athletes going on social media, posting photos of themselves using these devices and sort of showing that they're an important part of the recovery process. And I will say that some of these devices and things that I tested do have good uses and seem to stand up. But one of the drivers here is really this idea that there's something more you could be doing and you're missing out if you're not doing this. And the marketing really seems to exploit this fear of missing out and this idea that, you're not doing things quite right, and if you just optimize things a tiny bit more, you'll have spectacular results. And what I found is that was probably something that was oversold. In fact, in the book, I talk about an interesting study. So the Olympic Training Center, one of the Olympic Training Centers in Colorado Springs, has a recovery center, very much like the Denver Sports Recovery Center. Similar sorts of devices and tools available. But it was very interesting. One of the people running this place actually looked at the data at who had used the center and which athletes had spent the most time in the recovery center. And what they found is that the athletes who won medals at that Olympics, this is right before Beijing, had actually used the recovery center the least. And so, there are different ways to interpret this. You could think that, that just means that they were more talented to begin with and didn't need all of those things. But I think what it really points to is this idea that this is not the thing that's going to make the absolute difference between getting a gold medal and being an also-ran.
What if you think it's going to? There's the placebo effect.
Absolutely, absolutely. I'll just say one of the things when I was joking around with my book editor, one of the titles we played around with was Nothing Works Unless You Think It Does.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was never going to be the title of the book, but the placebo effect is very strong, and it's powerful, and it's real, and I think that we too often dismiss it as something that's not worth looking into or not worth using or that it means something doesn't work. But the reality is that the expectation about something can really create significant and real physiological changes in your body. And so the placebo effect is not something that should be dismissed, I would say, but something that we should look at how to exploit. And so in the book, I talk about there's an NBA team where one of the people in charge of recovery stuff for the team actually presents the players with an array of products that they can use in different approaches. So massage being one, warm bath, cold bath, et cetera. But they're given this opportunity and they're allowed to choose. And they're told that, you know, we don't know for sure that any of this stuff works. We think it might. Some people find that it helps. Choose the thing that you want to do. And what they found is if the player decides for himself which recovery method to use, it works much better than if it's assigned. And there's some interesting science here. Placebos that hurt, painful placebos, work better than things that are sort of neutral. So, for instance, a placebo pill is less effective than a placebo shot. I wrote a story. My day job, I'm the lead science writer at 538, and I wrote a story at 538 talking about placebo surgery and how so much of the benefits of some sorts of orthopedic surgery seem to come from placebo effects because, you know, it's this very severe thing that you're going through. There's all this ritual that comes along with it, and so it really creates this expectation of healing. And so I think it's a really interesting thing to think about, and in the end, I would say that so many of these things that are being used for recovery really do get their power in large part from the placebo.
And another thing that I found really interesting was your exploration and inquiry into lactic acid. That caught my attention because I feel that there was a time when I was doing various sports and I did choose into taking supplements. And one of the supplements was supposed to address lactic acid buildup and help me metabolize it more quickly. And I felt like it really did. It made a significant and noticeable difference for me. But now I wonder if that was just my mind telling me that that's what it was doing. And then people have all sorts of theories about supplements in general. And even if I have to say that even if this handful of supplements I took during my heavy training and racing days weren't really doing anything, but it was just a placebo effect, I would do it all over again because I really believed in them.
Yeah. So it's interesting. So with lactic acid, you know, we used to think that lactic acid is what made you sore after a workout. I remember my high school track coach would say, "Oh, you gotta do your warm down. You gotta shake out your legs to get the lactic acid out." But we now know that lactic acid is not the thing that's responsible for soreness. And it's also interesting because it turns out that our muscles and our bodies clear it quite quickly. So the sort of ironic thing is that by the time you get around to, you know, or have a chance to use some of these things that are supposed to clear lactic acid, the reality is that your body has already cleared it itself. And so that claim, and in fact I talk about in the book that, you know, if you're looking at a product that's claiming to flush lactic acid, that's, you know, you can just drop that. You know that's not how it's working, if it is in fact working at all. So that's a pretty interesting thing. And then you also mentioned supplements, and I'll just say that I have an entire chapter in the book about supplements. And the bottom line, I guess if I were to summarize it in one word, it would be don't. The U.S. Anti-Doping Agency in Colorado Springs, they're the group that's responsible for drug testing Olympic athletes. They actually have an educational program going to educate athletes about the dangers of supplements. Mm-hmm. There have been so many athletes testing positive on drug tests because a lot of these supplements are tainted. They have they can have a remnant of hormones, steroids, other banned substances, and this really comes down to issues of manufacturing, and you have products that are being made in the same factories with other things. But the bottom line is that supplements are not very regulated compared to medicines and things like this, so it could be really hard to know what you're getting. And when I looked into the research, it turns out that most of these things that are claimed to help with performance and recovery supplement-wise just really aren't held up by good science.
Well, I have one thing that I do, Christy, and it's I take Sport Legs, and I don't know if it's placebo. Are you familiar with that product, Sport Legs?
I don't know that product. No,
it's funny. It is the one thing that I have continued to do, and I swear by it. Other people swear by it. But again, it is It's got some, you know, calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, supposedly a patented delivery system. And when I read something like that, a patented delivery system, mm-hmm. like it might just be vitamin D, but it's the way we deliver it that makes the big difference.
Right.
It sort of sends up a red flag, but I love it anyway. But you're probably saying, yeah, placebo.
But again, I mean, if the placebo works, look, I'm not advocating that people get scammed and they spend money and time and effort on things that don't work. At the same time, there are a lot of things that have explanations that are incorrect, but that you know, the thing actually helps. And so I'll give you an example. These pneumatic compression boots, people yeah. love them. They really do. And there's a lot of claims that are made about them, one of them being like flushing lactic acid, right? But these things really do seem to be beneficial, and I've talked to coaches who use them and athletes. But I think that a lot of the power of it comes from you're sitting there with your legs up
yes.
for a half an hour or something, doing nothing else. And so what it's really doing is just enabling you to do some sort of recovery ritual and to spend time and to give recovery the time and attention that it deserves. So, and it also makes you feel really, really good. And I'll just point out here that at its most basic level, recovery is relaxation.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that helps you relax, anything that makes you feel better, that's good. That's recovery. Do it. Like, that's working. You don't need some pseudoscientific explanation to tell you that that's worth doing.
Right. You're a fan of massage, and one of the claims of massage is that it increases blood flow. And I thought it was interesting in your book that you say most athletes have really good blood flow anyway. But this is, I would say, increased blood flow is a lot of things fall under the umbrella of increasing your blood flow. And that might be foam rollers, which we all have one of those sitting in our corner. I have at least three of them, of course. Can you talk a little bit about blood flow and then about foam rollers specifically?
Sure. So I have a whole chapter in the book about, I think it's called Flushing the Blood, about increasing circulation and things like this. But one thing that is interesting, as you say, is that athletes tend to have good circulation to begin with. And I'll just also say that the best way to increase your circulation is to exercise, you know. And, you know, when I was a high school athlete, we would do a warm down. That was what you did to flush out the blood. And that's actually a really effective way of, you know, keeping your circulation up. You'll see sometimes cyclists will get on their trainers and just spin after a hard event or something like that. So easy exercise is like the most effective way to increase blood flow. You don't need fancy gizmos and devices. But, you know, with massage, I think one thing that's really interesting is that it also promotes this kind of body awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a way of checking in on how you're feeling on the various body parts and figuring out, oh, I'm really sore in this spot, or I have a knot here in my muscle. And so that may have benefits that are a little bit less tangible and hard to measure in a study or to quantify, but it may be that that's a really important part of this. And so I think that athletes who have something that's really working for them, they feel, I wouldn't discourage them from doing that, assuming, again, that they're not, you know, wasting money or, you know, harming themselves, or it's not a source of stress. One thing that I learned while researching this book is that so often what ends up happening with many athletes is they become so anxious and worried about doing all of these recovery techniques that recovery itself becomes a source of stress.
Mm.
And the problem here is that recovery is supposed to be the time when you're unwinding and you're letting go of stress and you're allowing your body to repair itself and sort of let go of those things. So if recovery is getting to the point where it's becoming its own source of stress for you, it's time to sort of revisit what you're doing.
Hey, let's talk about the aging athlete. Do you find anything,
yeah.
mostly because I know that Dave Hanscom, who's got a few decades more under his belt than I do.
Way to blame it on Dave Hanscom, Len.
Well, you never know it. I mean, good luck keeping up with that guy. He's,
yeah.
he's an incredible athlete and an amazing person as well. So I am also an aging athlete, and the truth is all of us are,
yeah.
right? No one gets older by the year. But one thing that if you are over 40, as I am, you notice is that your recovery needs go up with age, and this seems to be inevitable. Trust me, I looked long and hard for the special technique for recovery that was going to, you know, erase the effects of aging, and I failed to find it. But the reality is it just takes longer. Your body takes longer to recover as you age, and I think the best approach here is acceptance. But there's also some intriguing evidence that perhaps protein is helpful for older athletes, that as you age, your body is sort of not as good at taking up protein. So it's really important for older athletes to be sure to get enough protein. And this doesn't mean eating a bunch of protein shakes all the time, but just making sure that you're not skimping on protein in your diet.
Christy, you're making me feel really good because one of the last events that I did, I happened to do with Lynn. It was that wild horse or crazy horse thing, that 7-hour bike ride. And did I do after that, Lynn? I laid on the ground in a near-death, almost catatonic state, which I claim is my recovery pose. And I let all the stress go, and I just relax for a long time. Remember, you couldn't get me to get off my back. You even took pictures of me.
I thought you were dead.
But, Christy, so sleep and rest and letting the stress go. It's really kind of that simple. Do you have one recommendation for people? Is it meditation? Is it, you know, as you said, spending that half hour with your legs up? What is it that you would recommend to our audience for recovery?
Well, I'm going to actually make two recommendations. So the first is sleep. Prioritize sleep. Make it something that's just like you're not going to skip your workout, don't skip your sleep. I think too often people just think they're too busy or it's something that they are willing to sort of skimp on, but you shouldn't. And it's not just for your workouts and for athletic performance, but everything else in your life. So get enough sleep. That's number one. But then the second one is to find some sort of recovery ritual that works for you. And by ritual, I mean figure out something that you can do that is a way of relaxing, and it's a habit that you have that really sort of tells your mind and body, okay, this is time to relax. I'm going to just spend some time here, just completely relaxing, not feeling stressed. And so that can be, it can be getting a massage. It can be just putting your feet up. It can be taking a nap. It doesn't matter, but I think the important thing is it's something that you do regularly, and it's something that becomes sort of a habit so that you are giving recovery some time in your life, and you're giving it a bit of priority, and you're taking the time to really give yourself over to it.
Well, see, and that brings us full circle right back to where we started, drinking a beer.
That's right. That's right. I love it.
Christy Ashwanden is our guest. Her new book is Good to Go, What the Athlete and All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery. A great book. Christy, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.